Good morning. It's Friday, December 14th. This Christmas feels kind of funky. I keep wondering whether global warming might result in an unrecoverable negative feedback cycle, turning Earth into another Venus. What a nightmare. Practically no informed speculation even remotely approaches such a scenario. I did find one NASA scientist who's also wondering about it. But even if we knew it were possible, I suspect we'd still stupidly be doing what we're doing for now. A not-so-cheery holiday thought. Welcome to Electric Politics. I'm George Kenney. The subject of today's show, population, was suggested to me sometime back by Judy, one of EP's earliest regular listeners. Indeed, without Judy's encouragement, I probably wouldn't have gotten to it on my own. Well, maybe, but not for quite a long time. It took enough time anyhow, but as I often do, I hadn't forgotten, and I had continued thinking about population in the back of my mind. Then, one day, when I followed some internet links about Al Bartlett, I realized he was exactly the right guy to talk with. There are others, mainly biologists, who are big on population issues, but Al brings an exceptional professional pedagogical background and a profound commitment to population, along with broader issues of sustainability. Al and I talk for an hour and 12 minutes. Let's listen. Today, I'm delighted and honored to welcome as my guest Dr. Albert Allen Bartlett. Al is a professor emeritus of physics at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's also a highly regarded international voice on the problem of sustainable economics, particularly as regards population and energy, subjects he's been working on since the late 1960s. Al is a former national president of the American Association of Physics Teachers, where he remains active. He's a fellow of the American Physical Society and of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And he's a founding member of Plan Boulder County, an environmental group for the city and county. His BA degree is in physics from Colgate, and his MA and PhD degrees in physics are from Harvard. He was born in 1923 in Shanghai. Welcome, Al.
Thank you very much.
Very early on in your career, you worked on the Manhattan Project right after you graduated from Colgate. And I assume that you continued in the field of nuclear physics, although I wasn't able to find out much about what you were doing as a physicist. And I was just curious, what areas of research were you interested in as a physicist?
Well, at Los Alamos, I worked on a mass spectrometer, and we were looking at the isotopic constitution of the first plutonium that was coming down from the reactors at Hanford.
Mm-hmm.
And at Harvard, I did a thesis in beta ray spectroscopy, a nuclear energy level determinations, and I continued that here for a while and then gradually shifted into teaching physics, an emphasis on teaching and in trying to improve educational processes in the teaching of physics. So I've shifted over to that, and then, as you say, in the late 1960s,
mm-hmm.
I got involved with energy, and that's been sort of a main preoccupation ever since.
Well, that was an interesting time. In the late 60s and early 70s, I guess in 1972, the Club of Rome published its Limits to Growth book.
Yes.
What was it in those years that got you interested in the questions of energy and population?
Well, the first aspect of this was that I came to realize that people didn't understand the very large numbers you get with just modest growth rates for modest periods of time. And you encounter this perhaps most frequently with compound interest on a savings account in a bank. And if you get 5% interest in the bank account, why the bank account will double in size every 14 years. And then a few doublings, like 10 doublings, gives you something 1,000 times what you started with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And people didn't, and you know, I was surprised with some of the numbers that came up with this. So my first lectures on this were on just the simple arithmetic of steady growth. And then I realized that when you applied steady growth to the rate of consumption of a resource such as coal or oil,
mm-hmm.
that the life expectancy was dramatically shortened if you had steady growth, the rate of consumption of the resource.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And people didn't realize this. And then I would come across reports on U.S. coal, and here would be a statement of U.S. coal that it's enough for 500 years at present rates of consumption. Well, if you put in a modest growth rate and imagine that you could maintain that growth rate till the coal was gone, then the coal would be out in 100, 150 years. Now, over the years since that 500-year figure was published, that was almost 40 years ago, now we find that a report from the National Academy of Sciences sometime in mid-2007
mm-hmm.
said that coal reserves the United States would last something like 100 years at present rates of consumption.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's quite a ways down from 500 years.
When you're working with these figures, and particularly when you started working with these questions in the late 60s, were there any particular resources that you found helpful in learning about it, or did you just get indexes with the numbers and do the math yourself? Or?
Well, I became aware of the work of Dr. M. King Hubbard.
Uh-huh.
And he's a geophysicist, and he was writing on resources.
Yeah.
And on how long they would last. And so I read a lot of his stuff. And in fact, what I still use as my Bible in thinking about all these things is a report that he authored for a committee of the Congress. And this is the title, U.S. Energy Resources, A Review as of 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a background paper prepared at the request of Henry M. Jackson, chairman of the Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs of the United States Senate. And it was published by the Government Printing Office in 1974.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, this is a very comprehensive report. It comes to something like 260 pages, and it has in it all the data, all the analysis, and all of the results and projections. And the data are, the calculations rather, are at the level of first year college calculus, so that there's nothing difficult about it. And I now use the cover sheet of this as a slide in my lecture to point out how long the Congress has had a chance to know about this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, Hubbard first published his results for the Hubbard curve for U.S. petroleum in 1956. Now, that's 51 years ago. Nobody paid any attention.
Yeah, I was born in 1956.
Well, he projected that the U.S. oil production domestic would peak around between 1966 and 1971.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it peaked in 1970. And it's been going downhill dramatically ever since then, with one little jiggle on the downhill side when the Alaska pipeline started delivering oil. There was a partial recovery, but then that production has now peaked, and everything's going downhill in unison on the right-hand side of the curve. So I became aware of his work. He spoke here at the university once, had a nice talk
yeah.
with him, and I got to know him.
Uh-huh.
And as I was lecturing around the country, one time I was lecturing in Washington. I knew he lived in Bethesda, so I phoned him and invited him to come over and hear me, which he did very kindly. And since I drew so much on his work in my lecture, at the end I introduced him to the audience, and to great applause, because he was a very far-sighted guy.
And probably better known even today than then.
I think so. The Hubbard curve is now a term in the general language, and that's happened in the last 10 or so years.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. And then as you were working with the question of energy, at some point you realized that an even more fundamental factor was population.
Well, first of all, before that, it came to me that public officials were making statements that were just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Things that were just totally at odds with the facts. And that many of these public officials and executives of corporations, and the corporation people were just committed to growth. We've got to have growth. And so shifted the focus around to growth, the arithmetic of growth, and where growth gets you in terms of using up resources and so on and growing populations. And so the population thing came in rather gradually, and it became very clear that essentially all of our problems in the world today are due to overpopulation. And I like to observe that with global warming, that if any fraction of the observed global warming can be attributed to the actions of humans,
mm-hmm.
this by itself is positive proof that the human population, living as we do, has exceeded the carrying capacity of the Earth.
Now, I've read where you've written that a couple of times.
Yeah.
Can you explain that, please?
Well, you know, if there are so many of us using so much energy that we are heating the global atmosphere, that just says there are too many of us, or we're living too high on the hog. So we have to cut back either our per capita consumption, that would be an unpopular thing, or we have to reduce our population. And that, many people in this country say, would be an unpopular thing, but it's happening in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and it's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you say to people who argue that we have to have a growing population in order to pay for the retirement of people who are older?
That's a very legitimate question. It's a very real problem, but it's trivial compared to the problem of just continuing our growth of population.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Social Security system is a Ponzi scheme, which is based on growth. And it works for a while as long as the growth continues, but at some point it collapses, fiscally collapses on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem with Social Security. It was based on a growing population, written back in the 1930s originally by members of Congress who apparently must not have understood the long-term implications of continued population growth. And so it has to be reworked, and you know, the only options are reduce the benefits or increase the payroll taxes.
So in other words, instead of having the people currently working paying the benefits of people who previously had worked, a more sensible way would be to have people throughout their lives pay in some way that's invested, so they're essentially paying for themselves, I guess.
Well, I don't know. That's an option that I don't favor. That's just a personal opinion. This was pushed by the president here earlier in his term. And so many people, you know, if they have discretion to spend their money, they will sort of waste it away, and then suddenly they're old and need public assistance, and so they will become charges to the public at some point. And it's much better, I think,
mm-hmm.
in a real sense, to have everyone mandatory, make a contribution. Now, you ought to base it on the salaries, how much you make, and then your payout ought to be based on
mm-hmm.
how much your salary has
mm-hmm.
been in
mm-hmm.
the last 5 years, something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, people who are extremely wealthy, they don't need Social Security.
Right, right.
And, but most of the population does, and you find all kinds of cases of widows whose husbands were unwise with their discretionary spending of their money, and then they leave a widow with little or no resources to carry her through the rest of her life.
Right, right. Now, what you're saying makes perfect sense to me. One of the arguments that supports immigration is that all these new immigrants are going to help pay for Social Security, and yet it seems that whether legally or not, if you bring a large number of young immigrants into the country, you're creating an interest group that's strongly in favor of further immigration.
Yeah.
And then, as you've pointed out in various places, the higher standard of living in the U.S. Means that we're depleting resources faster than other people in other parts of the world. So if you add more people into that mix, you're getting faster global resource depletion. Why doesn't the immigration issue get cast in these limits to growth terms, do you suppose?
It's politically incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
If you say much about immigration, you're likely to be cast as a racist or something like this. And so it's a very touchy thing. I have a paper on immigration that's just in press now with negative population growth, but it's just looking at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the numbers just tell us, you know, the U.S. population today, as we are, is not sustainable, period. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot continue very long on this present path. And much of the alarm in Washington about the energy problem just reflects that. And it reflects that we're totally dependent on people who are not entirely friendly to us for our petroleum, which is the lifeblood of our country.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a very precarious position to be in.
Well, do you have an estimate of what a sensible level of population would be for the United States?
Well, you can't have a closed formula that gives you a firm number.
Okay.
Because you have the first thing you have to plug in is, well, how well do you want to live? If we all wanted to live like people in Uganda, well, you could probably pack another couple hundred million people into the United States.
Sure.
But we don't want that. And so we would like to live well. And David Pimentel, who is a global agricultural scientist at Cornell University, he has estimated that a sustainable U.S. population based on today's U.S. average dietary level
mm-hmm.
is like half of our present population, like 120, 150 million, something like that, like the population was at the end of World War II.
And you reckon that even if we were to adopt a zero-growth population, that it would take at least 70 years to be made effective?
What happens is, and I didn't understand this till I made a model on my computer, is that if you have a growing population, because, for instance, the fertility rate is 4 children per woman, that gives you a rapid growth population. If you suddenly on the computer say, when just from now on, we're going to only have 2 children per woman,
mm-hmm.
your first thought would be, okay, then it becomes stable. Well, it doesn't become stable until every individual has died who was living at the time the change was made. It gradually approaches stability.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a growing population and suddenly, by magic, you changed the fertility from 4 down to 2 children per woman, the curve slowly stops growing and finally levels off after about 70 years.
Wow.
And so that means the decisions we make today on population, we won't see the full effect of those for 70 years.
And yet at the same time, as you point out, the time horizon of most politicians is just, you know, 2 or 4 or 6 years or something.
No, it's they're a complete mismatch.
Well, taking another slice at it, maybe, in one of your papers recently, Springer Verlag, actually it looks like a nice collection, you and Mikhail Gorbachev and Herman Daly and papers from a number of really interesting people, you put out a number of laws. And your fifth law is one cannot sustain a world in which some regions have high standards of living while others have low standards of living. Could you explain that? That's a little bit confusing to me.
Well, I think that lots of the terrorism and turmoil that we see in the world today
mm-hmm.
involves the have-nots versus the haves.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as there are these different standards of living and people know about the standards are different, why they will be taking actions to try to equalize them. And these actions often take the form of, if things are too frustrating, then the actions become actions of terrorism. And so it's interesting that the modern technology, we've been able to make television sets and put television into even straw huts in the darkest parts of the dark continent.
Mm-hmm.
So the people know what they're missing. They see American movies, and they see all the trappings of very high standards of living, and they're living in poverty, and this is frustrating. And if they can't solve the problems, get things, their own lives equalized and higher standard of living, why, then that's their breeding ground for terrorism.
I'm not sure I see the terrorism connection, but no doubt there would be a lot of discontent. Well, take Africa though as an example to explore. A lot of people argue that the world is already past its carrying capacity. But if Africa were brought up to the same standard of living as the U.S., we'd be many times over even the carrying capacity that we've exceeded today. So
that is correct. That's the estimates. You know, there's a very nice analysis called ecological footprint analysis that was developed by Professor Bill Rees and his student Mathis Wackernagel at the University of British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
A nice little book that they wrote, Your Ecological Footprint. And they estimate that today the population, some living poor, some living very well, that our total footprint now is like 1.2 Earths.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to bring up everybody up to the present U.S. standard of living, it would take another 5 or 6 Earths.
Yeah.
And so that's just to emphasize what you said a moment ago. And this then makes the problem even more difficult. You can quickly estimate that there aren't enough fossil fuels existent in the total Earth to allow the underdeveloped populations of the world to come up to our standard of living on any reasonable time scale. You couldn't do it in, you know, less maybe than 100 years. There aren't that quantity of fossil fuels around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the die is cast. So we're living in a very precarious position.
Well, it's sort of a zero-sum game, and to the extent that we're, it's a policy conundrum too, because to the extent that we're providing aid in places like Africa, we're in a sense exacerbating the problem, right?
That is correct, and you have an even more difficult thing by saying all of modern medicine is making the problem worse, because by extending lifetimes, you increase the rate of growth of population. And so what we've done is we've accepted with great eagerness the benefits of modern medicine,
mm-hmm,
without realizing that there's a responsibility that goes with that, and that is to reduce the fertility rate so that the improvements in medicine don't just yield a higher growth rate of our population.
To take another example, China. China is growing so fast, it doesn't seem possible to me that anybody could go to the Chinese government to say, well, gee whiz, you're growing too fast, you're using too many resources, slow down. So at what point does their growth start to collide with the rest of the world?
The answer is anytime. It's colliding right now, and but it's interesting when the Chinese put in their very coercive one child per family policy about 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Their official statement of justification was words to the effect that population growth interferes with economic development. Now, you look at the economic development that they have achieved in those 30 years, and you look at the fact that their population policy has cut their growth rate in half, so they're still growing, but the growth rate is way down from what it would otherwise have been.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you could say that that reduction of the growth rate is one of the big sociological accomplishments in all of human history. But they're still growing. But they recognize that having population growth just interfered with economic development. So they chose economic development, and they're doing very successfully at that. Now, there's another interesting aspect of this. With all their consumption of energy, a lot of it's rather primitive, and they're burning big quantities of coal every year, putting lots of greenhouse gas into the air, lots of contribution to global warming. But when it comes to the international agreements on what do the countries do to reduce global warming, I see reports now suggesting that they are going to these conferences and saying, look, our population policy has avoided the births of something like 300 million people. We've avoided those. And that's, by the way, that's roughly the population of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We've avoided all those births. We've avoided all the pollution that those people would contribute. So we've already made a gigantic contribution toward reduction of global warming.
That's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that at all.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. It's extremely interesting. And do you know what the response to that argument is?
I only heard it of just a few weeks ago, so I came across it somewhere, and I have not heard a response to it.
It's a pretty strong argument.
It is.
Do you happen to know what the current population growth rate in China is?
I'm sorry, I don't, but I'm going to guess it's 1.5%, something like that, per year. And, you know, on a basis of a billion people, that's an enormous growth rate.
Yeah.
That's like 10 million a year.
So, in your mind, that the Chinese still have an incentive to cut back on their population growth?
Yeah, because it helps their economic growth. Their economic growth is now giving them leverage by which they can have enormous fiscal impact on the rest of the world. A big part of our public debt is debt to them for sending us over toys and stuff painted with lead paint and various kinds of things that have been very deleterious to our health, as well as televisions and all kinds of electronic gear. And so all the money they're making off of that, they're going to be controlling a big part of the U.S. economy, because they can come back in with that money and buy up U.S. corporations. The Saudis have been doing that, and some of the other Arab states have been doing that with their oil revenues, so they already own a big chunk of the U.S.
I saw some report the other day, just parenthetically, that some Russian company had bought up an automobile manufacturing plant in Detroit that had closed and was shipping it off to Russia to build trucks.
Interesting.
Yeah. It is such a serious consideration that population is going to be the kind of the ultimate limit. I guess that's your 21st law of extinction is forever.
Right.
What is your sense of how people respond to these arguments? I mean, we've got a lot of intelligent people here in the United States, maybe a few more intelligent than you, certainly plenty more intelligent than me. How come people aren't paying attention, or what's your sense of the way that people do pay attention or begin to learn about it?
Well, you know, I think there is still some trust in government. And I first encountered this after 1 year of college. I dropped out for a while, and I worked on iron ore freighters on the Great Lakes. And I was a dishwasher on the first one and a night cook on the second one.
And you took a lot of photographs when you were doing
that. I took a lot of photographs. But I used to wonder, we run up and get something like, 10,000 tons of this rich Mesabi iron ore, take it down to Buffalo, New York, throw it in the Republic Steel Mill furnace, run up and get another 10,000 tons up and down. I used to wonder, will we ever run out of this stuff? And I can remember saying to myself, don't worry, Al, you're just a dishwasher. If there's any problem, there are smart people in Washington who are looking at this, and they will sound the alarm in time for us to avoid a catastrophe. And I'm ashamed to admit how many years it was before I realized that's completely wrong. The people in Washington are not smart in that way, and they will not warn us in advance of possible real trouble. And this just goes back to my citing this report from 1974 written by Hubbard for a committee of the U.S. Senate. Everything's there, the predictions, the projections, and that should have set off alarm bells. Instead of that, why, it was just filed away. Nobody paid any attention. And I've got one. I don't know whether I sent you a copy of that paper on resources in Australia.
Yes, you did. I read it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, here is the Minister of Resources of Australia in an article in an energy magazine boasting that Australia is the largest exporter of coal in the world. And he goes on to say with great glee, we have 110 years worth at present rates of consumption, and we're growing 5% per year. Well, now look at the implications, the stupidity of this statement. First of all, 110 years, that should be sounding alarm bells instead of great rejoicing, because 110 years is not long compared to the life expectancy of a major industrialized nation.
Mm-hmm.
He should be sounding alarm bells, say, gee, we better save some of this for future people in Australia. Then he sticks by that 110 years and says it's growing 5% per year. Well, it's a little bit of easy arithmetic to figure out that if it's growing 5% per year and would last 110 years of present rates of production, it's going to last much shorter, down around 30 years, if you continue that 5% growth. And so what I did in that paper was you can take how long it'll last at a present rate of consumption and the present rate of growth of production and plot a plausible future scenario for the production of the resource.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those, and for instance, for those figures, that those figures, it turns out that the production in the future will peak something like, I'd have to look it up, 20 or 30 years down the road. And after that, it's all downhill. There's no way you can get around that. And it would peak at something like 50% higher than the present rate of production.
Getting at what you're saying about the common sense notion that governments would want to retain some of their non-renewable resources, there's a sort of new term of art, I think just appearing in the last year or maybe less, the idea of an export peak for oil, for example, where countries that are large exporters realize, perhaps looking at examples like Indonesia, that exporting countries are very likely going to turn into importing countries, and they ought to conserve the oil that they've got for their own uses and for future generations. How much does the idea of an export peak affect the idea of peak oil, do you think?
Well, I think that point of view is a very responsible one, to say we don't want to ship this oil off to other countries. We and our descendants in our home country, we're going to need that oil, and so let's just keep it here. And you see, this then runs counter to all the international trade agreements that have been so much discussed and so much debated. Those international trade agreements, I suspect, are motivated in part by the developed nations, such as the United States, wanting to get our hands on the resources of other countries before those people of those other countries develop to the point where they will need the resources themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so these trade agreements are just going in the wrong direction. And one of the terms you hear now in the discussion of international trade and energy is we want energy security. That is, we want guaranteed supplies so we can go on wasting energy at our present rate or a growing rate for a few years in the future. And that's what they call, you know, economic security or petroleum security. And But that means that we're doing this at the expense of other countries. And so it's a modern colonialism. The old colonialism, why the European nations sent people to distant countries to sort of take over the countries, manage the resources of the countries for the benefit of the people back home. Now we have tried to do it by these treaties and so on, and by military action, as in the case in Iraq, to go in and make sure that we have some resources that we can count on for at least a few years.
It's still not clear, I think, to the general public, although you're starting to see more articles in the Financial Times and Wall Street Journal and other establishment publications that begin to broach the subject of peak oil. Where do you see a catalyst occurring in the near-term future that would get people's attention about the fact that there's a certain limited quantity of oil on the planet?
Well, I suspect it'll just be a further increases in oil prices. It's, you know, it's $90 or $95 a barrel now, and it will certainly cross 100 early in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that as the high prices go, prices rise, and they will rise steadily. At some point, the Wall Street Journal will realize that we're dealing with a finite resource. They still, down there at the editorial board, they still worship the late Dr. Julian Simon, who essentially said the world is infinite, we can grow forever. I've got a copy of an article he wrote in the Cato Institute newsletter saying we can go on growing our population for 7 billion years. Well,
yeah,
this is just outrageous. But for some unknown reason, they seem to worship him down there in the high financial circles. And you see the same thing, sort of thing, in Forbes magazine, where they seem to think very much like Julian Simon did, that there's no limit to anything. We can grow and do anything we want. And they just, I don't know how these people, by any measure of degrees and so on, are people who should be thought of as highly educated. And how they can come to these conclusions just staggers me.
Well, it actually doesn't surprise me at all, because I spent too many years as a graduate student in economics at the University of Chicago, and I never finished the PhD. I was specializing in the history of economic thought, and I had a lot of problems with various people who were modelers and so forth and on a theoretical level. But that was the doctrine, that basically resources are infinite, and that whenever anything becomes too expensive, substitutes will appear because of the magic of the market.
Yeah.
And a corollary to that, I was always kind of surprised. Though I focused on the history of economic thought, I also studied some economic history. And the idea there about population is that, I don't know if this is still the standard line, but it certainly was the unquestioned view in the Chicago school when I was there, that population increases are always and everywhere a good thing.
Yeah. Well, you see that clear down to the level of local chambers of commerce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've written about that.
It's one of the great tragedies of all times, and it's totally, it's a destructive, very destructive tragedy. And I have recently talked with some political people who are, you know, generating policy statements for the politicians for whom they work, and they are absolutely afraid of saying anything about population growth.
Well, in a sense, I mean, to draw upon what you were saying a moment ago about colonialism, and I want to emphasize here that when you say that, you're absolutely serious and you're not exaggerating at all. But to take it maybe a step further, when people are arguing in favor of population growth, in favor of all these other things, what it really is, whether consciously or unconsciously, it seems to me, you've got people arguing for the idea that some smaller group of people is going to own pretty much everything that other people use.
Yes.
And it's to their benefit to have this idea.
Well, yeah, and well, there are winners and losers. And I remember speaking at West Point in October of 2000, Mm-hmm. When I got on the plane at Newark to come back home, I just picked a magazine out of a rack, and it was Forbes, for I think it was October 2 of the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And here was a 24-page special advertising insert in that magazine saying, come to Colorado. We've got a wonderful environment. We'll destroy it any way you want it destroyed.
And here are all the bankers
and the big real estate people and some of the political leaders saying, we welcome you, bring your factory, bring your people. We've got a good workforce that won't unionize, and they'll work for low wages, and on and on and on. And you know, I almost had to use the barf bag. And I thought to myself, well, when I get back to Boulder, I will go to the business school library. I look up that issue of Forbes and make a copy of that ad. So I went over to the business school library. The issue is there, but the ad was not in the issue.
Hmm. So it wasn't advertised
in Colorado. I think they can target those zip codes. So I had to write to a friend in Oregon, would you please go to your library, make me a copy of that ad, which he did.
Huh.
And so, and here are these big bankers and real estate people and everyone saying, oh, and, you know, here in Boulder, they talk about, we're a pretty progressive town in many ways in terms of going, being green, and talking a lot about sustainability. But none of the talk about sustainability includes limiting population growth. And it's hard to do in the Constitution of the U.S. You've got to at least start talking about it and trying to see what you can do. And, of course, the one thing that you can do is to try to make the growth pay for itself. It doesn't pay for itself now. The growth in the municipalities it just causes taxes to go up. And I did an analysis years ago with some data from the 1970 census, and it showed that if you go in the U.S. from a city of one population to one of twice that population,
mm-hmm.
the municipal per capita annual taxes in the larger city of the two it was about 20% to 25% higher than it was in the smaller one. So there are no economies of scale in municipal government. The bigger you are, the higher the per capita annual taxes have to be.
Hmm.
And so the growth never pays for itself. And I had a wonderful exchange with a Colorado state legislator years ago, and we were arguing about growth. And he said, well, he said, we couldn't stop Boulder's growth if we wanted to. And I said, I agree. Therefore, let's put a tax on the growth. So as a minimum, it pays for itself. And he almost shouted at me. He says, you can't do that. You slow down our growth.
Well, could you imagine having a political party that has as one of its main platforms no growth? I mean, maybe it's possible. I've actually talked, one of my guests has been a British politician who talked in very candid, very intelligent terms about not being able to promise growth forever, but you don't see that here in the U.S.
None at all. No, they still are under the magic control of these people, like you mentioned, the economists. And it was very interesting. Some years ago, I gave my talk at the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And my host was a Ph.D. non-scientist. And after the talk, and I talked in the talk about the Hubbert curve and the projected shortcomings and so on, and he took me out to lunch afterwards, and over lunch he said to me, quote, you don't have to worry about petroleum. We've got everything under control, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't convinced him, and he certainly didn't say anything that convinced me. But here he was, highly credentialed educationally, but he didn't understand the problem.
Do you follow the current pronouncements by the Energy Information Administration at all closely?
Not closely.
Mm-hmm. Guy Caruso, the administrator, was one of my first guests, and I should ask him back at some point to see if he's at all becoming more cautious in the last 2 years. But it's hard to get the Department of Energy to focus on things. I used to have to work with them a little bit when I did energy oil security. I was an oil security desk officer at the State Department for a while, and so I had a lot of dealings with the Department of Energy. And They live out of their file cabinets, and it's very, very hard to get them to change the contents.
Well, you know, it was a few years ago, and I saw this in the Oil and Gas Journal, and it was a statement from the Secretary of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
This was like 1998 or something like this. And he's initiated a whole new energy policy, and the goal of this policy is to reduce the decline in U.S. domestic oil production by the year 2005. Well, you know, if you look at the Hubbert curve, that curve is going down. You could work hard and put a little bump on the downhill side of the curve.
Right.
But you can't really reverse the decline. You'd be better off trying to stop the rotation of the Earth while the sun's over the U.S., and then we could get a lot more solar energy.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any guess as to when the global peak will happen or whether it's happened already?
Well, my paper published in the year 2000 said that if, and this is a result of analysis, so my analysis showed that if the world's total resource of conventional petroleum was 2 trillion barrels, then the peak should occur in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the 2 trillion came from the geology literature, and I searched the literature to find out what do geologists, I'm not a geologist, what do geologists think is the total amount of oil we'll ever find on this Earth? Well, that's where the 2,000 billion barrels, 2 trillion barrels came from. And it's quite uncertain, plus or minus maybe 40%.
Mm-hmm.
So then if I plugged in, well, let's go to 3 trillion. That's 50% higher. When does a peak occur? And it showed 2019. And if it's twice what the consensus figure is, it moves back to something like 2029. It moves back at the rate of 5.5 days for every billion barrels that you add to the total world endowment of oil. Every time you find a new billion barrels, that moves the peak back 5.5 days.
That's pretty amazing, especially considering that nobody's finding any more of those large fields.
The large fields have none of them been found for, what, 30, 40 years?
Yeah, something. I don't know exactly, but for a long time. What Guy Caruso says in response to that point is, well, the big increases are coming out of known fields, and so not to worry. But the biggest known field in Saudi Arabia is kind of a mystery to us. The Saudis don't tell us exactly what's going on and ask us to take on faith the fact that they can produce oil forever.
Have you read Matt Simmons' book, Twilight in the Desert?
I haven't. I know of it, of course.
Well, he's a financier in Houston, very active in oil circles, and he said that ever since the Saudis took over Aramco from the Western oil companies, they quit releasing data. And he said, we don't even know how much oil they're producing there a year, except by counting the number of tankers that go out through the Straits of Hormuz.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did then to try to get the much information he could, the Saudis have had their engineering staff have been allowed to publish scientific and engineering articles in the scientific journals. And I think he found it, maybe it was 200 or 300 articles. And he studied all of these articles to try to piece together what was going on in the Saudi oil fields. And his initial conclusion was that there is no way that they could play the role they've done for many years, and that is raise production a million barrels a day whenever the White House calls to say, price is a little high, could you put some extra on the market to bring the price down?
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a startling thing. This was before the book came out. This was such a startling thing that the Saudi government issued an official denial. And that sounds to me like affirmation by
mm-hmm.
denial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so then he published the book, and he says that they're in very severe trouble in all of their big fields, that they're pumping water in way too fast, and I don't quite understand the mechanics of this, but if you pump water into a field to bring the oil up closer to the surface, pump it in too fast, you cut off some of the resource before it can get out, and it traps it underground so you can't get it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so he thinks that they're at the peak production now, and that there's no way that they can increase it by any significant amount. And the idea that they might go discover some new, very productive fields, he said that place has been reasonably well explored, and there's no real geological indications that they might find more.
There's a lot of discussion on the website, the Oil Drum, about the Saudi fields, Ghawar, and the rest of it, and technical details. Did you ever get a chance to talk to Simmons?
You know, I've met him, corresponded once or twice with him briefly.
Mm-hmm.
He and I each received the M. King Hubbert Award at the first meeting of the ASPO USA. It was held in Denver here. And,
oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and he was there, and he and I, Walter Youngquist and somebody else, there were four of them given, and Walter wasn't able to be there. He was quite ill at the time. And so I met Matt there, and I've corresponded with him once or twice. He's a remarkable person.
He's certainly done a lot for publicizing the problem. And what's interesting to me about him is that he's a relatively recent arrival in terms of the peak oil paradigm. It wasn't until maybe 6 or 7 years ago that he began to realize what was happening, even having been at the top of the investment business in the oil industry.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, is this a kind of an insight, do you think, that might propagate quickly, that there'd be some sort of a shift in public opinion along with the change in oil prices? Or do you think that people are resistant? Or how do you see people's openness or not to these ideas, peak oil
population? Well, I think people first, they have this trust in our leaders, you know, that our leaders have all the access to all the best information in the world, and they won't lead us down a primrose path where we hit a dead end. That is a false thing. And I think they also have a lot of faith in science, in technology, in the sense that they can solve all the problems. And, you know, there are a lot of problems that have been solved by science, but one of the critical things that scientists need to remember is, and that's Eric Severide's law, which I have in that paper there,
mm-hmm.
the chief source of problems is solution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's now beginning to be some discussion of geoengineering or global geoengineering, where, you know, they're going to put up aerosol clouds to reflect away some of the sunlight to try to cool down the earth a little bit, and things like this, or put iron in sulfates or something in the ocean to try to increase the ocean productivity. Well, now you're messing with nature on a really big scale, and we don't know the consequences of that. So Eric Severide says there will be big problems, and you can be sure there will be. These are, you know, it's the same as the law of unintended consequences. And I don't think it would be wise at all to mess with any of this big scale geoengineering, in part because this would sort of support this naive belief that people have that science and technology will save us. And if we say, oh, well, we can geoengineer our way out of this, and then they say, oh, well, it's all right, I'll buy my Hummer and keep going.
A large number of scientists began to sound the alarm, do you think that would cause people to pay attention?
Possibly. It seems to be working finely with the global warming.
Mm-hmm.
But you notice how reluctant people in Congress have been to accept, even after the scientists were way up past 50% certainty that it was human activities that were causing global warming.
Yeah.
You still had people like Senator Imhoff from Oklahoma who were saying it's the biggest fraud ever perpetrated on the American people, or words to that effect.
Right, right.
Still denying it. And people just have to see the thing, and the place where you can reach people is through their pocketbook. And if the price of oil just keeps going up, this will be reflected in every aspect of our society. And in my talk now, I use the term copycat curves to say that when the world oil peaks, a lot of other peaks will occur in segments of our society that are dependent on petroleum. For instance, tourism, which mm-hmm. is dependent mainly on airlines.
Mm-hmm.
airline flights will peak in number and per year, and the mileage flown will peak, and so all the big resort people who invest big millions in resorts to try to attract tourists, they'll see a decline. This is sort of the topic that's in Richard Hindberg's book of Peak Everything. Everything in the society is going to peak.
And peak water?
Well, water is a little bit different because it's a renewable resource if you're talking about rainwater and so on. If you're talking about underground waters, aquifers, it's very slowly renewable, and some of it is very slowly renewable. So, water is a separate major problem, and we've got out here in Colorado, which in the 1880s or something was listed on maps as the Great American Desert. We've got all of these big cities growing, and they all want water. The water table around Denver is falling very rapidly. We're bringing a lot of our water in from the western slope, which means expensive tunnels to bring it through the mountains and so on. But the population growth just keeps going up and up and up, and they're talking about draining some of the nice mountain valleys and just to get the water out and get it out here so we can grow. And yet the politicians believe the numbers, and I've seen these printed many times, that they may come out of a state demographer's office or something, saying, well, we've got to look for another, we'll expect another million people in the Front Range here in the next, I don't know, 15, 20 years, something like that. And this is a dilemma. If you plan for them, then this will facilitate their coming. If you don't plan for them, it's not clear that they won't come, but at some point we've got to simply say we don't have the water. And we're asking people to cut back on their watering their lawns in the summertime and cut back on other water use and all of this sacrifice just so this population growth can continue.
Yeah.
Look at the city of Atlanta. I don't know how they fared in the rainstorms a few days ago, whether that did any really important renewal of their water storage capability, but they've been growing like mad, and they're out of water. They're taking water from every place they can get, and now when you have a drought, they're not ready for it, and they don't have any reserves. And yet I suspect that their newspapers and their political leaders are all talking about growth, 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 growth.
And it's the same thing in Las Vegas, huh?
Oh, that's terrible. Las Vegas is drying up the farmland up in the northern part of the state. They got all their money. They can go up there and buy the water rights and take the water away from the farmers. And I don't know the law, but I've understood that the water use has priorities, and the highest priorities for human use.
Mm-hmm.
And a lower on the list is agricultural use. So this means that if a city's out of water, they can go to a farmer and, through court procedures, can condemn the water and take it over by eminent domain, pay the farmer an agreed-on price that the court agrees on. And so this is interesting, carried to the absurd limit. It means that we will have water to flush our toilets in the cities, but we won't have water to grow food, so there'll be nothing to flush down the toilets.
Yeah. Yeah, and you write about the non-renewable nature of agricultural land and the need to conserve it because people do need to eat.
And you've seen the figure that the estimate is that the average item of food on our dinner plate has traveled something like 1,500 miles from where it was grown. You know, you see the ads on television for grapes grown in Chile in South America. This is insane.
Now, Al, mostly you're observing and you're charting out where mathematically possible also fairly clear trends. But from what I've read, you're not writing much as sort of a quote unquote futurist. And I'm wondering, do you spend time thinking about what kinds of possible worlds we're creating, guesses, optimistic, pessimistic, or is that something that you kind of prefer not to think about? Or,
well, I do think about it because I now have some great grandchildren. But and I worry about what kind of a world will they inherit from us. And I don't know. Predicting the future is a very risky business, but it's easy to do. I close my lecture that I've given now over 1,600 times.
Mm-hmm.
I close my lecture by saying, don't take what I've said blindly or uncritically because of the rhetoric for any other reason. Please, you check the facts. Please check my arithmetic. If you find errors, please let me know.
Mm-hmm.
I say these are not predictions of the future except for those petroleum graphs where I did my analysis and the petroleum peaks were in 2004 and 2019 and 2029, something like that. Except for those, I'm not making any predictions of the future. And I'm asking you, the audience, to think about, well, what's going to happen when we have a declining world production of oil, and we have a growing world population, and we have a growing world per capita demand for oil. What's going to happen? And I ask the audience to do the thinking and project and see what they think the future will be like.
It's a tough, a very tough thing to think about. And it's not clear that the educational system is really doing much to help or not.
That's right.
As you've said. Al, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you're thinking about that you might like to talk about for a couple more minutes? Or,
well, it's let me just think for a minute here. The business of coal. I think I may have mentioned earlier that U.S. coal now is estimated to be maybe 100 years of present rates of production.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get to the environmental groups, they're very opposed to building new coal plants to generate electricity, for the generation of electricity. Because coal is terrible stuff. It pollutes like you wouldn't believe. And we should avoid it. So, well, then what do we do? Well, some of the technological people say, well, we build nuclear plants because they don't put out any greenhouse gases. Well, the environmental people are very opposed to those. So the only things you've got left are hydroelectric, which is not likely to expand in any significant way because of the big consumption of land, and all the good hydroelectric sites are already dammed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get to wind and solar.
Mm-hmm.
Wind is derived from solar, obviously, but those things are essentially infinite in the time scale. But solar is a very low density. And so solar energy input onto a square meter of collector area at high noon on a clear day is the order of a kilowatt. And the best conversion efficiencies I've heard of for converting solar energy into electricity is like 20%. So this means at high noon on a clear day, you can get the order of 200 watts electrical power from a square meter of solar collector. Well, if you look at the label on your toaster where you toast your toast for the morning breakfast,
mm-hmm.
that's 1,000 watts. You're going to have 5 square meters of solar collector at high noon on a clear day in order to run your toaster.
And how many toasters are there out there?
Well, yes. Your electric iron is typically 1,000 watts. Most of these heating things are like 1,000 watts, a waffle iron or some of the other heating devices, the order of 1,000 watts. A clothes dryer, I think, is something the order of 3,000 watts. So you have to have special wiring in to get the power into a clothes dryer. So the question then is, What are the environmentalists going to do? They will not touch population. And the most prominent objection to this is from the Sierra Club.
Is that right? Really?
Yeah, they will not touch population in the U.S. Now, they have a population committee, and I see things from there time to time, and they're moaning very sad stories about population growth in the rest of the world, you know, point to them and say it's their problem. And the interesting thing, and I first heard this from Tim Wirth, who was then, at that time, a United States senator from Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke here at the university. He said, you know, we can't go tell these other countries, the people of these other countries, that they've got to stop their population growth because they're wrecking the earth. We have to set an example and stop our own population growth before we can go lecture to them and tell them that they're wrecking the earth. And it turns out, of course, that when you, and I think in the Reagan administration, some American representatives tried this at a population, global population conference, and the response from the people in the underdeveloped nations was, look, a child born in America will in that child's lifetime have maybe 10 or 20 times the impact on global resources as will a child born in Africa, say. And their response was, you go home and take care of your own problem. And the Sierra Club will not touch population growth in the U.S. Now, they used to. They used to talk about, but they changed, a big change. And there have been efforts on the part of the membership, but by petition, to elect people to the board of directors who understand the problem and will start focusing on population. They, in some of the dirtiest campaigns I've ever seen, they defeated the most of the candidacies of these people who understood the problem. And so it's a terrible tragedy. And, you know, there used to be a group in Washington called Zero Population Growth. Mm-hmm. I was a member of that for many years, and I was even on the board of citizen advisors, which just meant my name was printed on the letterhead in a long list of names. And I would read the magazine that they put out every 2 months or so, and once I just chanced to read the fine print with the letterhead, the identification of the journal, and it said zero words to this effect: zero population growth is our goal, and sustainability in the U.S. and the world. And when I just chanced to read this, I found it said instead of that, what it said was, we want to have slow population growth and sustainability in the world. Well, there were three big objections to that. I immediately wrote to the chairman of the board of directors and said, look, this is fraudulent. The name is zero population growth. You're advocating slow population growth? Come on, that's truth in advertising. Then you say slow population growth and sustainability. You know that you can't sustain slow population growth. And then thirdly, why did you leave out the U.S.? Well, I got back a nice three-page letter, said nothing. So I just dropped my membership. They have since changed their name, so they don't exist under that name anymore.
But to go back to the coal plants and solar. So what happens if I tend to favor wind and solar, and I'd like to see a lot more research into solar so that we can maybe boost its efficiency. I don't know how much that will help, but so what's the answer there then, as you see it?
Students and people often ask me that, and I have to say so. You know, sometimes problems don't have answers. you know, a big problem with wind energy is that it is unreliable in terms of time. It's on, the wind is blowing or the wind isn't blowing. And it drives the utility managers, their dispatchers of electric power, crazy because they know what the demand is pretty well statistically, what they have to have.
Yeah.
And if a big fraction of their resource that they're using is unreliable, then their job of dispatching and making power available uninterrupted and so on is very much made very much more difficult. So they can work maybe 5% of the electric into the regular electric grid. But if you talk about working 50% in, I suspect you'll find dispatching problems and managerial problems of shifting the load to sources here and there and so on that will be so difficult that it'll be very slow coming.
As a former nuclear person, do you have an agnostic view on nuclear? Or?
Well, nuclear, as long as it's working right, is quite safe. There's nobody in this country that has died from an accident in a commercial nuclear power plant. There were people scared, quite reasonably so, at Three Mile Island. And after the Three Mile Island, a colleague of mine asked me once sort of rhetorically, he said, wouldn't you think that to get a license to operate a nuclear power plant, that is an individual at the control room, to get a personal license, you'd have to be at least as well educated as an airline pilot? I said, yeah. Well, he said, all you need is a high school diploma.
Wow.
Well, and then of course, Chernobyl, there were some untrained operators who were just screwing around with thing to try to see what would happen if they did such and such, and it just went out of control and cluttered up a good share of Eastern Europe with all kinds of radioactivity. But now, if it's managed well, but, you know, if it's managed by humans, it's not going to be managed well.
The solution is the problem again.
I think that I
take your point to heart about how the U.S. should set an example for all these problems, and before we run around telling other people how they should fix things to our advantage, we should really fix things
ourselves. Well, the last U.S. president who was concerned about populations, Richard Nixon, he chartered a big study committee, and the report is called the Rockefeller Commission Report.
Hmm.
Their conclusion was they could see no benefit to the U.S. from any further population growth.
No kidding.
Yes. Go to Google. Just Rockefeller Commission Report.
Huh, that's
all
that's
there.
Very interesting.
And, of course, with all of Nixon's political problems, that got put on the shelf and forgotten.
To my mind, Nixon was the last real liberal president that we've had, but he's not generally thought of that way.
Yeah.
One last question, please, Al. I like your definition of a conservative, and can you explain that for me briefly, please?
Well, it's I used this closed some testimony that I gave before a subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives, and I said, you know, an energy policy that calls for digging and drilling and slashing and burning and consuming and so on, by any objective definition, that has to be thought of as being a liberal policy. And contrast that, if you say, well, let's not use so much, let's save on energy, let's save some energy resources for our children and our grandchildren, let's conserve, by any measure, that has to be called a conservative policy. And my question then to you, the members of the subcommittee, is, where are all the conservatives when we need them? And that got a few chuckles, and nobody paid attention. But I think the labels so often used just to tag people, liberal or conservative, I think they're just reversed. The people who want to conserve and save energy and go to wind and solar and so on, they're called liberals. And the people who want to just burn and drill and everything, and the free market will take care of everything for us, they're called conservatives, and the labels are just reversed.
Yeah. That's the one area where I'm hopeful that there can be kind of a fusion of people who share common interests who will sort of slash their way through these verbal differences and realize.
Yeah.
Al, I want to thank you very much for talking with me. It's been a great pleasure, and you've got tremendous insights. I think the work you're doing is great, and I look forward to following the articles you're writing. It's just, you're an amazing example.
Well, thank you.
Great. Thanks again, Al. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the party's over. Most people don't know it yet, but there you have it. I guess Malthus was only about 200 years ahead of his time. Hopefully, technology can pick up a lot of the slack. And if we can get a handle on population, maybe human beings can survive a few thousand more years or longer. Odds are, however, there's no guarantee. Okay, on to next week. Please see the schedule I posted at EP, which is still valid. Thanks very much to everybody who wrote in last week, particularly several notes from new listeners. I'm always happy to hear from you, and I will write back. usually sooner rather than later, but sometimes it takes me several weeks to gather my thoughts. Please remember to contribute, if you can, to EP's ongoing costs. All donations are welcome and very much appreciated. And good luck to everyone getting ready for Christmas. That's it then for this week. As always, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring you these shows. Thank you very much for listening. And please stay tuned to Electric Politics.